Hello, and welcome to The 305, the podcast where we watch and review the entire original Criterion collection on Laserdisc in order of release. This is your host, Jonathan Irons, and today we are watching Spine Number 11, The Hidden Fortress, or in its original language, Kakushi Toride no San Akunin, literally The Three Villains of the Hidden Fortress, by Akira Kurosawa. Our guest this time is Nick Oberlander from California up by San Francisco. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how familiar you are with this movie?
Jonathan asked me to be on because I'm his go-to Star Wars nerd, and I think we'll get a lot into how influential this was on that particular piece of media. As for my familiarity with this movie, it's not at all. I have not only never seen The Hidden Fortress, this is my first Akira Kurosawa movie. So I'm actually super excited to be on today and talk about it.
Which I'm still a little shocked by, having gone to film school with you, that you've yet to see a Kurosawa movie.
Yeah, it's a huge gap in my like film knowledge. And every now and then I'm like, I'm going to sit down and watch all of Akira Kurosawa's movies. And then I just kind of don't do it. So I'm really excited, you know, and I've heard and read that this is like a really good kind of onboard for Kurosawa's work. Cause this is a very accessible, very kind of light, kind of popcorn-y type movie that he did like purposely just to make a fun movie.
Yes.
And, you know, so I'm excited to kind of see how that, you know, like as a Kurosawa novice, you know, kind of how I come into it.
And I'm coming into it from almost the opposite direction. I've seen at least a half dozen of his movies, which still isn't much out of, he directed some crazy number like 60, but I've only seen his more serious later samurai films. So I'm also very curious to see how this big budget blockbuster sort of movie goes. Let's see, I can tell you that this movie was released by Toho, which has been for a long time the largest movie company in Japan. It is a samurai film, which over there they call chanbara, or a subset of period films from that era called Jidai Geki, which was during the 1500s period of Japan. Lots of civil war happening.
So is that sort of like the way, like in the States, we would make a Western that like takes place in a very, very limited like span of time in our history and is very like thematically similar and that type of thing?
Yes. And that's like one of the most common points of reference for Westerns is the samurai film, just because of how influential it was on the Western genre, including maybe the most famous one would be Seven Samurai becoming the Magnificent Seven.
Right, right.
Yeah. It stars Toshiro Mifune as General Makabe Rokuroda. His co-star is Misa Uehara as Princess Yuki. And then our two sidekicks are Minoru Chiaki as Tahei and Kamatari Fujiwara as Madashichi. This film, I couldn't find any budget numbers on it, but I assume it was pretty large because Kurosawa had already had a lot of international success in this decade. But it did become Toho's top grossing film for the year in Japan and the fourth highest overall. While in the US, it made, in today's dollars, about $430,000 at the box office.
Not quite as popular over here? No.
Which I'll get into in a moment. As far as the Laserdisc itself goes, this is a three-disc box set. There are no special features because the movie takes up everything on the discs. It is shot at a 2.35:1 aspect ratio with mono sound and originally retailed for $89.95 or today $211.46 for one movie.
God, these things were insane, weren't they? These yes. Laser discs. That's crazy.
Uh-huh. Even at the time. It is 139 minutes long, but in America, for a long time, it was only available in a cut-down version of either 2 hours or an hour and a half, and that was the one that the critics panned in America. I read that it was restored in 1984 to its original runtime for the first time, and so this Laserdisc, as far as I can tell, is the first time the complete movie was available in America on home video.
Mm.
And lastly, I will point out that Kurosawa, this is his first entry in the Criterion catalog, and he is actually the most represented director in the entire collection with 15 of his films in there out of 305.
Is that in the 305 here, or is that the total Criterion collection, like including the modern like DVD Blu-ray releases?
Just the original Laserdisc. I'm sure he has more movies at this point in the DVD and Blu-rays. Definitely a lot of stuff worth checking out, or at least they felt so. And with that, I think I will leave our audience into the mysterious world of streaming, and we will watch this movie together.
All right, let's do it.
Bye, everybody.
A boy in Paris discovers an unlikely companion in the red balloon. A young fisherman finds a kindred spirit in White Mane.
Coming up next episode, we've got a French double feature of shorts, Le Ballon Rouge and Corn Blanc, or The Red Balloon and White Mane. The Red Balloon is still the only short to have won the Best Oscar for Original Screenplay, and White Mane took home the Short Film Grand Prize at the Cannes Film Festival. And now, back to The Hidden Fortress.
Welcome back, everyone. We have just finished our very first viewing of The Hidden Fortress together. A lighthearted comedy romp, if you will.
Kind of.
The plot summary, for those who haven't seen it, would be that two peasants, C-3PO and R2-D2, encounter an Akazuki general named Rokurota and agree to help him transport the clan Princess Yuki and all of their remaining gold across enemy territory to a secret allied base. And they do end up doing so through a series of mishaps, essentially. Nick, first, have you ever watched a Laserdisc?
I think my only other experience with a Laserdisc was in the first grade. We watched Pinocchio on a Laserdisc, and that was like that very first, you know, the teacher wheels the TV in on the cart kind of thing, and we're like, what's this? And I do remember that it was one of those that you couldn't pause it, and you couldn't, like, there was no chapters like a DVD, so we'd be watching part of the disc and be like, oh, it's lunchtime, and then we come back and she was like, well, I don't know what to, I guess, okay, we're just starting this disc over, and then we had to rewind like 20 minutes.
Oh, man.
Because that was the only way to keep watching it, was to just watch like from the beginning of that side of the disc. and I thought that was pretty funny.
Thankfully, the one that we just watched is a type that does allow you to pause and has chapters and everything. There's two different kinds of laser discs where one of them you could fit more on the disc, but mm-hmm. you didn't have any features, like even just pausing the movie. Or you could pause, but it would go to a blue screen. It wouldn't show you like a still frame.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one lets you do all kinds of trick features, like you can do slow motion and rewind and repeat and all this stuff. Well, what are your first thoughts on the movie, your initial reactions? Lay them on me.
I really enjoyed it, you know, especially, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect coming in, you know, with my being my first Kurosawa and all. And I think I've heard from many sources that this was a very accessible one, and it is, like, it's just kind of, it's fun. It's easy to follow. You know, you have the goofy peasant characters, throughout, you know, very simple, straightforward plot. And yeah, it was a pretty good time. I think there's definitely some pacing issues.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think you mentioned that there was a shorter cut that was the one that was in the United States, and I'd actually be interested in seeing that one.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think you could probably get this down to about an hour and a half and still have like the same movie, if not a structurally stronger movie. You know, there's a lot of stuff lingers. There's a lot of like the exposition scenes where you have like not a lot of story being put forward, and then a lot of dialogue really quickly to get a lot of the story out of the way. So kind of that back and forth.
Yeah.
So, but it's still like it's a fun kind of, you know, adventure. You know, I got a lot of like, you know, like we were talking about the Western vibes. It felt kind of like, I kept thinking of Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Oh, I haven't seen that one yet. Is that Humphrey Bogart?
Yeah, yeah, it is. And it's kind of, you know, but it's like people finding gold in the mountains. And it's like, you know, so not, there's not much similarity beyond that, you know, other than just like the, like, and it, that comments much more on like, you know, human greed and what, you know, what, how much of your humanity you're willing to give up for your greed. And this was obviously a much more lighthearted take on it. But the peasants kind of had that vibe of like scene to scene, their only motivation for the entire movie is just what is best for us right now, be it getting the gold or getting food or getting water. You know, that's their only goal, you know, for those characters. And it really doesn't change. I think it's kind of funny that that's all that they do for the entire movie is just what is best for us right at this moment.
Yeah, they're very consistent right up until the end.
Yeah.
Until the last shot, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, did Bogart find gold inside of Styx?
In Treasure of Sierra Madre? No, I believe it was, that was the standard finding gold inside of rocks versus...
Oh, okay. Okay, gotcha.
Processed gold inside of firewood.
I'm still... I'm curious how they managed to pull that off. If they, like, just kind of jam the gold in from the side, or...
Yeah. Is it one of those like they wrap gold around like a tree when it's a sapling and then it grows into it and they've been working on this for this years?
Plan for decades, yeah.
Yeah. Well, if things go south, we have the gold forest that we can chop down and hike hundreds of miles. Mm-hmm. It's not a great plan, but it's a plan.
This sounds like there's always money in the banana stand.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, I would love to dig into the Star Wars stuff a little bit later on in our influence section. But first, I figured we could go over just a little bit of background on the movie.
Sure.
And who made it, especially since you're new to Kurosawa. So the brief summary I can tell you would be that Kurosawa himself was actually born to an old samurai family, had a long history going back in Japan. And as a boy, he studied art and film and theater and sword fighting, and just really got in all kinds of creative pursuits. And then in 1936, he started as an AD at Toho. And he worked with a mentor, Kajiro Yamamoto, for 17 films. Before he finally got his chance, his first movie as director at age 33 was a samurai film called Sanshiro Sugata. And then he continued doing mostly samurai and gangster films through the rest of his life. I did notice that cast and crew-wise, there was a lot of people that I knew from other movies that he'd worked on. And I read that he had a group of people that he would consistently make movies with called the Kurosawa Gumi or Kurosawa Group. And Theron, one of my other regular guests, keeps insisting that whenever Orson Welles comes up, I need to add in a new Orson Welles section called All's Wells That Ends Wells.
Okay. And
this would be the time in this episode for that segment, because just like Ingmar Bergman and Orson Welles also came from the theater and then got into a film career and then used a stable of cast and crew throughout their lives, Kurosawa falls in that camp as well. And I found out that in the late 40s, Kurosawa had wanted to do Macbeth as an adaptation for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he just finished Rashomon and was thinking about doing that as his next project when he learned that Orson Welles had just done a movie version of Macbeth 2 years prior, forcing Kurosawa to postpone his movie for another decade.
But I do like that he was like, well, I'm not going to not do it. I'll just wait a little bit.
Yeah.
And then it'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. And that became Throne of Blood. One of his later ones, I believe, also with Mifune in the lead role.
That is interesting because you kind of get some of those like Shakespearean vibes from this too.
Oh, sure.
Like, I feel like, you know, the character pretending to be a mute is a very, like, Shakespearean kind of a thing that you would have. And then, like, the fool characters, you know, who kind of flop around and are a part of this greater story than themselves, you know.
Sort of a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah, kind of. That type of thing. Like, it definitely has those kind of elements.
Yeah, I could see that. And very... I don't know that you could really compare the plots, but it reminds me of like Richard III from Shakespeare or Henry V or all of those big epic historical plays.
Yeah, definitely. It, you know, has like the, you know, I think literally at one point somebody says like, bring me a horse. And I'm like, ah.
Let's see. So in 1951 was when Kurosawa made, or sorry, it was when Rashomon from the year prior had been shown at the Venice Film Festival, and it won the Golden Lion, which was a huge shock to everybody. It won like the top prize, and suddenly everybody in the world knew about Japanese cinema, where it had been this like hidden gem for a long time. So he largely was responsible for people getting interested in Japanese cinema. And I can't remember if you mentioned in the intro while we were watching the movie, but he had just done a string of really like serious, dramatic, artful movies before Hidden Fortress, and then turned around and said, okay, I'm just going to do a fun one this time. His quote was, I want to make a 100% entertainment film full of thrills and fun. How well would you say he succeeded in that?
I mean, I think so. I can't compare to like, you know, what those former films were, or, you know, or like, you know, the heaviness or artfulness. But yeah, I mean, this definitely is like a romp. Mm-hmm. You know, this strikes me as like your popcorn flick, and kind of it's in that same vein, you know. And as we transition into a little bit of talk about its influence on Star Wars, mm-hmm. you know, it has that feel of kind of those old serials of just, you know, it's an adventure of characters out in the woods, and, you know, they're mm-hmm. trying to get a thing from point A to point B, and, you know, the various ways they succeed or don't succeed, and the, you know, the laughs they have along the way.
They've even got a superhero almost in the general character who has the strength of 10 men, it would seem.
Yeah, very much so. He's picking stuff up left and right. It's kind of like he's only carrying 200 kilos of gold. Like, I feel like he could have just like strong-armed a few more bags and they would have been fine.
Yeah, it seemed like he could have strong-armed the other two guys and been fine.
He did at one point. He just lifted them up and threw them into the water.
Yeah, well, he did that, and then later he picked both of them up off the ground with their gold while he was holding his own gold.
Yes.
And continued on his way. So he may have been either demon or robot in the... I'm going to skip that part. Sometimes my jokes don't land at all.
Yeah. I feel like that's a segment you need, though, is, was this character a demon or a robot?
I'll have to see if that theme keeps coming up.
Yeah.
All right. So then for the cast, obviously we've got Toshiro Mifune in the lead role, one of the most famous actors of Japanese cinema. Did you know about him before this movie?
Yeah, I've certainly, just because you can't really talk or hear about Akira Kurosawa without Toshiro Mifune kind of being spoken in the same breath. Like, I feel like they're like the tops of like the director actor relationships, because he wasn't they mostly work together, aren't they? Just kind of, isn't like almost all of their work, or at least all of their famous work, the two of them working together?
Yeah, pretty much. They did 16 films together over the course of their career. And I think with like one exception, Mifune was the lead in all of them.
But I mean, I can see why.
Yeah, no kidding. It's the eyebrows, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I feel like this comes up on the internet every now and then, where people just kind of like are like, you know, a little reminder of how ridiculously handsome Toshiro Mifune is. And yeah, like he is, like has such a screen presence. He's incredibly like charismatic and straight up stone cold fox.
coincidentally, he actually got his start in the movies in 1947 as an assistant cameraman.
Oh, wow.
crew for a long time for Toho. And then he started getting into a little bit of acting because his friends pushed him into it. They like submitted his information to an audition without his knowing about it.
Was it just a picture of his smile?
Probably. And then Mifune saw him because I missed what year it was. Oh, it must have been 1948, I guess. Toho was holding this huge talent search, and they were auditioning hundreds of actors with some judges. And Kurosawa had planned on skipping the event, but he showed up because a friend of his said there's one actor who seemed really promising. And Kurosawa wrote that he entered the audition to see a young man reeling around the room in a violent frenzy. It was as frightening as watching a wounded beast trying to break loose. I was transfixed. And when Mifune, exhausted, finished his scene, he sat down and gave the judges an ominous stare. He then lost the competition, but impressed Kurosawa to the point that he cast him in his next movie, Drunken Angel, and started their illustrious career together. You asked about the peasant characters, if they were like stock.
Yeah,
characters.
I was curious about that. You know, if that was like, you know, if they were like character actors who played kind of that same type of role, you know, and then if it's one of those where it's like, you know, oh, those two cards playing that duo again, that's great, doing their thing, or if they were just, you know, where they came from, or if they were nobodies, because I enjoyed them and they had a lot of like good banter and dialogue together, and since they're kind of carrying the film, I think that worked really well.
Right. I don't know for sure if they ever played another comedic duo like that. But between the two of them, they worked on about a dozen Kurosawa movies. I think I recognized the older, shorter one, Madashichi, from Seven Samurai. I want to say he was one of the seven, this like older one. Very gaunt looking.
Yeah.
And then I think Tahei might have been in it as well, but I couldn't quite recognize him. But they were character actors. They each had a long career in Japanese movies. There's one anecdote that I thought was pretty funny, that while they were working on this movie, Fujiwara, who was the older guy, he was drinking one night with Mifune, and they just got blasted, and Mifune was being a super arrogant jerk. So at one point, Fujiwara got so upset with him that he used a karate blow and knocked him on his ass. And it said, rather than being angry, Mifune laughed, but behaved well for the rest of the filming.
Because we all need to be kept in check sometimes.
Especially by your elders, I guess.
Yeah, apparently.
And then finally, the lead actress, her name is Misa Uehara. This was actually her film debut at age 20. And she only worked for 2 years in the film industry, but managed to make 9 films in those 2 years.
Why did she stop? Did she just get burned out from making 9 films in 2 years?
Entirely possible. Wikipedia was not able to tell me that one. It just said she, after a brief career, she left acting. And her last movie was in 1960. Looks like an obscure one called Daigaku no Sanzokutachi, which I cannot translate for you. But yeah, did you have any particular notes or things that you liked about the cast in this movie?
Yeah, I think in general, especially kind of the four leads there, I think were very good. I really did enjoy the princess character because they kind of introduce like the concept of her as like this damsel who needs to be escorted and protected and stuff like that. But for the most part, she seems pretty capable of speaking for herself and defending herself, and has really no, you know, she's not demure by any means at all. And I like how that's actually the problem. They're like, hey, look, you you need to be a mute because otherwise you are just too much and will immediately get us caught. And she's like, fine, I'll do that.
I liked the when she caught on and she was like, look, don't use this reverse psychology on me, all right?
Immediately. He's like, hey, I got this. I'll reverse psychology her. It'll work great. And she's like, no, it won't. Stop doing that. I'll do the mute thing. I don't care. Let's go.
I noticed also that she wore like a blouse and shorts through basically the whole movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if tomboy is the right word for it, but like she was never seen as a real princess until the very end.
Right. And there was a brief comment from one of the elders that she was, you know, raised like a boy because her father didn't have a son, which is, you know,
oh yeah,
like it, kind of the unfortunate trope of like, well, the only reason she's strong is because she's like a man, which is, well, that's kind of a bummer, but you know, very much, I think just that's the only excuse any storyteller had at the time.
Mm-hmm. You actually just reminded me that elder in the cave, that actor was Kurosawa's other main collaborator on his earlier films. They did like a bunch of movies together where he was the lead.
Mm.
And so this was basically just a cameo from that guy. I guess he was just like another member of the clan who hadn't been killed.
Yeah, they just had these couple of just elders in a cave hanging out, figuring out what to do, and then presumably dying and setting the fortress on fire after they left.
Right. Yeah. I made a note of that it seemed ironic to me that the title Hidden Fortress was burned and destroyed halfway through the movie.
Well, like discovered a third of the way into the movie and then burned like two thirds of the way in.
Yeah. I read that the Japanese title, I mentioned this at the very start, was The Three Villains of the Hidden Fortress.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because that doesn't make very much sense either.
It doesn't. I was trying to figure out while we were watching, like, okay, which three are we talking about? And the best I could figure was that it was the general and the two peasants.
Yeah, well, I feel like they were kind of trying to do a, like, he says he's the general, but they don't think he is, and you as the audience aren't maybe supposed to realize he actually is the general right away until he like
right.
goes and meets the elders. And then it's like, oh, okay. Oh no, he is, he wasn't lying to them. Mm. So I think that's kind of the vibe I was getting. It's one of those where like in retrospect now, because any of the synopses you read are just like the general and the two peasants
do this
thing. And so it's like, well, we as an audience know from the beginning that he is who he says he is. But I kind of wonder if that's what they were going for originally, is a little bit more of an obfuscation of who his character was initially.
Mm-hmm. Like if you were going in to see this movie and you only knew the title, that you would assume that he was a villain right off the bat before being surprised that he was a general. Okay.
Right. Because they think he's a bandit initially and he kind of acts like one and stuff like that. And then when he's like, I'm this general, and they're like, no,
sure, yeah,
that's a famous general. That can't be you. And then like 5 minutes later, like, oh, no, okay, it actually is him.
Well, I would like to get into the technical notes here, because there were some pretty interesting details, I thought. First, I will mention that Kurosawa, I said that he had grown up doing all kinds of art and theater and so on, and he became known for that with his movies as well, that he would write or co-write all of his own scripts. He would oversee the design. He would set up all the shots. He would do the editing himself. Very much an early auteur. Oh, he also would be really closely involved with the musical scoring for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was a tidbit that he had extremely thorough notes for all of his movies. And on Seven Samurai, which he did a few years earlier, he had six full notebooks with detailed biographies of the samurai, including what they wore and ate, how they walked, talked, and behaved when greeted, and even how each tied his shoes. And for the 101 peasant characters in the film, he created a registry consisting of 23 families and instructed the performers playing those roles to live and work as these families for the duration of shooting.
That's amazing. I like when you hear about that. It's almost like method directing. like yeah, digging basically. So deeply into the lore of your characters and stuff like that. But I think that's kind of great to consider that information and have that, you know, kind of in your mind, because then when you have, you know, character questions or performance questions, like, well, they would do this, and, you know, it's, you just kind of have all that ready to go rather than either just not knowing or not caring or making it up on the spot. I think it, you know, it gives you, you know, especially for actors, it would give you a much richer foundation to start from.
Yeah, definitely. I know a lot of actors who appreciate that rehearsal process. It's a weird contrast with theater, that like in theater you rehearse for at least a month and figure all this stuff out, whereas a lot of movies you just walk on a set and shoot it for the first time, you know, maybe doing a table read beforehand.
You wonder sometimes, because I think some movies do rehearse more, I think, maybe than we think they do, but people just assume that they're coming in just off the cuff and turn the cameras on and going, you know, they're probably not like sitting and blocking out the entire film, but I think you just, you know, you really have to kind of find scenes like that, or they're just coming in and recording and shooting and doing their, you know, I've worked on plenty of films where you're just rehearsing on the day, basically.
Right. Take one is the rehearsal.
Yeah, exactly. You know, whether, yeah. I've had that argument with producers before. It's like, oh, we're going to roll on this and we're going to roll on rehearsal. It's like, well, then it's a take. Well, no, it's a rehearsal. Well, no, it's a take. You're recording it.
It's take a take R for rehearsal.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think you can tell there's something to be said for off the cuff performances and having a bit of spontaneity, but I think you need that foundation. And if a director is coming in with, you know, just like this rich, you know, backstory for characters, then you build such a deep foundation that when they do go off the cuff, then it's going to be so much more successful. So I think that's a great way to approach things, is with that extra level of care.
And I wonder, since he worked with the same people over and over again, I wonder if that loosened up at all in his later years, just because everybody kind of already knew what to expect and like how things would go, so they could do it almost without speaking to each other necessarily.
Yeah, I'm sure there was a level of familiarity.
Yeah, I hope I'm not remembering this wrong, but I believe I read that Mifune would like surprise people with his acting on different takes. Like, he had a tendency to be very energetic, like wild on the set.
Well, you see that here, like he, especially kind of early on when he's introduced, he has like these bits where he has this big boisterous laugh kind of out of nowhere,
right? Yeah,
all of a sudden, and he seems so, you know, stoic and, you know, solid to begin with, and then we'll just, you know, all of a sudden turn and be, you know, this, and so, you know, surprise the characters around him and I think the audience too. And, you know, you can see where that would come from, and, you know, kind of, it really adds a lot of flavor to the performance.
Mm-hmm. So then I wanted to talk about the cinematography. It was done by a guy named Kazuo Yamasaki, and this was his second to last movie of his entire career. He previously had done another samurai movie called The Lower Depths with Kurosawa just a year prior, but this particular movie was actually Kurosawa's first widescreen movie.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and Yamasaki had done, I think he'd done at least one widescreen movie before this, so he wasn't a total newbie to it, but they were using something called Toho Scope.
I saw that at the beginning, and I how all of those companies had all of their like processes for basically the same thing.
Yeah.
But they all called it their
all
own.
All called something scope.
Yeah.
It was an anamorphic lens system based on Fox's CinemaScope that was from 1953. I dug a little digging into all these different scope things, and basically my understanding is that there is, even though large formats had been played around with, or even what like really crazy widescreen formats had been done earlier, it wasn't until the 1950s where all the studios started really experimenting with it. And the first CinemaScope production was called The Robe, a biblical epic. And then Disney made 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And the first animated scope movie was Lady and the Tramp.
That sprawling epic?
Yeah, no kidding. The CinemaScope like lens system, which do you want to quickly explain what anamorphic means?
Sure. So an anamorphic lens essentially like squeezes the image down. So if you're actually looking at the film that an anamorphic shot is on, it would look like very vertically stretched. And then when it's projected, then a similar lens working in the opposite fashion then like basically spreads it back out. So you can, in the same amount of film as a full screen image, you can, you're squeezing in this entire widescreen image and then projecting it back for viewing.
Hmm. Do you know if there's any quality loss from that?
A little bit, and you know, and you'll see in a lot of. I didn't see it much here. It looked pretty sharp, but a lot of those anamorphic lenses, or especially around the edges, will have a lot of like odd aberrations and stuff like that, and you actually see it's fun. You see it a lot these days because as we've made the transition to digital. There is briefly like this period of, oh, it's so nice and clean and sharp and we need to really like, you know, amplify that up. You know, people can see so much now. And then there's now been kind of this back in slide into, well, it's so sharp that there's kind of no character to it. It just looks like video. So now a lot of filmmakers are going back and finding these old anamorphic lenses, you know, from like the 60s and 70s that haven't really been like modified or updated or anything. And they're just like, no, don't touch them. Don't like fix anything or improve or replace any of the glass. And then they use those on the digital cameras and kind of give it a more of like a natural softness. And you play with the image through the glass, you know, onto the digital plane, you know, which kind of harkens back to the look that these original anamorphic movies had.
Yeah, it reminds me of in video games, like we first had just 8-bit or whatever pixel art, and then they got progressively more realistic. But now we've seen a resurgence of people like intentionally using the old look or old technology as a like creative constraint.
Exactly.
Rather than a technological one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same way.
Yeah.
It's fun sometimes I can't think of what movie it is. There's one movie I know that I've watched a couple times where it's like there's one particular lens that they're using and it's so obvious. Like there's a lot of like this weird like aberration and blurriness and things like that. And it's only when they use like this one lens at certain points in the shot and it's like so obvious. It's like, okay, well that lens you should probably fix up a little bit. You know, that like that one, you know, especially back before you could kind of clean things up digitally, is like that one's so different.
Yeah.
You know, so but and it's fun, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of character to some of these lenses. And that's why you'll find like directors and DPs will go to like specific shops, like rental houses with specific sets of lenses and be like, no, I want to shoot with this exact set of lenses. And lenses last forever. Like you can go to some of these rental shops and just be like, oh, like, you know, these are the lenses that, you know, like Sam Peckinpah used on like, you know, some movie in the 70s. I want to use these exact lenses. Give me that set. And they'd be like, here they are.
Wow.
You know, stuff like that. Like, you know, like, yeah, lenses kind of last forever because they, you know, as long as you keep them clean and maintain them and nobody smashed them up in some like big action set piece, they're still around.
I can see that being almost like a lucky thing for a director, being like, the Peckinpah lens, surely this will help in my Western.
Yeah, you hear about that a lot. Like cinematographers and directors will go back and be like, oh, I made sure that, you know, we had this one set of lenses that I've used on other pictures. Like I only like to shoot with these and I always go to this house and get this set or this one lens. I'd be like, yeah, there's this 40 millimeter lens that this one house has. And I love it. And that's like the lens that we end up using all the time and stuff like that. So yeah, it's very interesting to kind of hear about, you know, and it makes you wonder like the same way, like Kurosawa goes to the same set of performers and, and artists for all that, you know, when you have like cinematographers who might go to the same, you know, they kind of have their go-to look and style and their set of lenses and certain film stocks and cameras that they always kind of go back to and form a style out of.
Like old friends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so speaking of lenses, when Fox invented CinemaScope in the early 50s, it turned out that they couldn't actually patent it because anamorphic lenses had already been around for several decades. And so the reason that there were like all of these other companies started making their own version of it was that they just didn't want to pay Fox to license their system. And because the patent was open, they all just made it themselves and called it things like TohoScope and SuperScope and all these other ones.
So it was all the same thing and the same lenses and the same style.
Yeah.
They just all came up with their own name for it. That's funny.
Mm-hmm. And originally, CinemaScope itself was it was very wide. It was 2.66 to 1. And then I think that was when they had a separate film strip for both video or picture and sound.
Mm-hmm.
But they found that it was just really cumbersome keeping them in sync. And so they added magnetic stereo sound. And by doing that on the same film strip, they shrunk the image size down a little bit. So it became 2.55 to 1. And then a little later, they added optical sound and shrunk it even a little further to the standard that we now are familiar with of 2.35 to 1. And one of the sound formats that was used when that finally happened was called Perspecta. And that was actually what was used on this movie, Hidden Fortress. It was a fake stereo process where they would mix the whole movie in mono, and then they could add tones that you couldn't hear into the audio. There were three different ones, 30 hertz, 35 hertz, and 40 hertz. And they had a device in playback called the integrator that would detect those different tones and split the audio to either the left, the center, or the right channel based on the volume of each tone. And so like you couldn't have completely separate sounds on the left and the right, but you could make the left quieter and the right louder in order to give the impression of sound coming from one direction or the other.
It's fascinating. It's kind of the same way they used to do 3D, where you'd be passing it through a color filter for each side.
Oh, right,
but
right,
then,
yeah.
But in this way, it's basically like an audio filter of with the different frequencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating.
So what we watched on the Laserdisc was just a standard mono mix. But I did read that later when Criterion re-released this on Blu-ray, they actually recreated the original Perspecta mix and put it into the surround channels. So at some point, I'm very curious to give that a listen.
Yeah, that's really cool that they would be able to take that and get that mix kind of redone like that.
I wonder what the process was, if they like had access to the original the Perspecta mix itself, or if they had to like fudge it together.
Like, I don't know, did they have access to like original negatives of the film when they're doing some of these restorations? So then maybe they had the original, like, you know, sound recordings as well. You would hope that they would be able to kind of track all that down if it exists.
Right. Yeah. I don't know on this particular one. Sometimes they give you a whole bunch of details on the transfer, which is really cool, where they tell you, yeah, we had the negative, or we had to go within fine grain interpositive or all these different things in order to reconstruct the movie.
Well, I thought the transfer looked very good from what we watched. I mean, I, you know, not knowing kind of how it compares to other Laserdisc, I thought it was quite nice. And I watched a little bit of the film before this. I cheated, by the way. I watched some of it beforehand, which on HBO Max is the Criterion, which I assume comes from the Blu-ray release.
Yeah.
And it looks very good. And I can't say that this looked like so much worse. So obviously they had a very high quality, either negative or, like you said, interpositive that they were working with, because, you know, there's only so much you can do to clean up an image. Like if you only have like a really old projection copy or something like that, you're not going to get there's only so much you can do to clean it up, but it looks pretty good, I think, both on the Laserdisc and on the HD version. So they must have had at least one high quality or multiple high quality copies that they were working with.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. I would agree. It was a really nice print. You know, no scratches or damage to the film or anything like that. Whereas I think I remember the two Hitchcock movies earlier in the collection were pretty poor quality comparatively. But those were from the like late 20s and early 30s.
Yeah. They're even less likely to keep those negatives around at all.
Yeah, because they'll catch on fire.
Or probably did catch on fire.
Yeah, that too. So I did want to ask, as far as sound and picture goes, what did you think, like, creatively about this film? How'd they do?
I liked it. I thought there was there's some fun stuff with the framing, and I feel like it makes sense that it was Kurosawa's first widescreen because he was kind of playing with the width of the frame a lot. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of characters like taking up the very like far edges of the frame, and you got a lot of the landscape in around there. And there are like a lot of shots of Toshirô Mifune just standing stoically in the background, glaring at people, like in the very, very deep background. Like he'd leaned on that a lot, but I kept liking that imagery. He'd kind of go back to that of these big vistas and the characters in the foreground, and he's way off deep in the background, you know, arms crossed, glaring at them. You know, I feel like he did that a lot, or he played a lot with, there's a lot of triangular staging where you have three people kind of in a triangle, and then he shoots kind of symmetrically between them with the focus center framed and stuff like that. And that would be a lot harder to do in a full screen frame because you just don't have that kind of real estate off to the sides. You'd be either doing just single close-ups or maybe a single over the shoulder, but he was kind of able to kind of broaden the world a little bit. And I felt like he was playing around with that a lot. And I liked that.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me a little bit of Hateful Eight. Cause I remember when that movie came out, it was noted for using 70 millimeter film, and it used, what was it? They had some special lens on that one too, where it was like really wide. And
yeah, Tarantino is one of those guys who, you know, he's digging through like camera house like things and just finding boxes and being like, what's this lens? Let's use this kind of a thing. I guarantee you that he found some random cool old widescreen lens that like John Ford used, and they're like, yeah, okay, cool.
Well, he did, even though that movie was largely like indoors, I noticed that he took advantage of the composition of the frame by putting multiple faces in the frame at different distances, all talking together.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, like you did, I saw Kurosawa playing with that as well. I remember there's one shot near the beginning of the two peasants and the general, where they were all three of them spread out in close up across the shot, which I thought was a neat effect.
Yeah.
Music wise, I noticed that, for me, I thought there was a lot of similarities to the Star Wars soundtrack. And it made me wonder if George Lucas like made John Williams watch this movie first.
Yeah. I thought so too, like just from the beginning, the kind of fanfare. And I wrote, I believe in my notes, I literally have a march with a lot of trilling flutes, which is like that doo-dee-dee, doo-dee-dee-dee-doo is like such a little like kind of motif that John Williams comes to in Star Wars a lot.
Yeah, I was sad we didn't have like an almost imperial march at some point.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I would call the kind of the main theme closer maybe to the Imperial March than like the actual Star Wars theme itself, because it has more of this kind of that driving force. You know, it's a little more militant than the actual theme.
Mm-hmm. And I think I'd have to go back and watch it again, but I think that theme, which is like also the general's theme, it usually plays when he's in battle.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds really, really similar to the theme from Seven Samurai.
Were they the same composer?
No, they were not.
Although you said Kurosawa had kind of a deep hand in a lot of that stuff, so.
Right, yeah. So I wondered if it was like an intentional allusion or callback. But the composer, I read that on this movie, it was a guy named Masaru Sato. And he started out as a student of another composer named Fumio Hayasaka, who was Kurosawa's regular guy for like most of his early works. And then both composers worked on Seven Samurai. So Sato was like an assistant on that one. But then the mentor, Hayasaka, died the next year. And so Sato ended up taking over and finishing the projects that they had in production, and then continued as Kurosawa's composer for the rest of his movies in the 60s. And his contribution, I think, was more... Like, I saw jazz was mentioned at one point in something I was reading, and I noticed that there was a scene when they were, like, the peasants were digging, where suddenly it started getting into just a little bit of jazz.
Yeah, they kind of do dee 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 dee, you know, kind of like, yeah, like the plinky kind of strings and little kind of upbeat motifs here and there.
Right.
Which, again, makes sense, because John Williams also started... as a jazz musician and had a lot of his, really? A lot of his theory comes from, like, you know, like coming back to themes and these little riffs and things like that, you know, and that's why you have all the different little theme bits in Star Wars. Every character kind of has their own oral motif that comes in. It's a very, you know, that's a thing he pulled from jazz, you know, of, you know, you always kind of, you come back to these, you know, to, you know, the head and play that for a bit and then go off and improvise, but you're always kind of playing in that same realm and coming back around to the same instrumentation here and there. So that it makes a lot of sense, again, why we would find such similar styles between the two.
Well, then for editing, that would be the last technical thing that I wanted to talk about. I think I said earlier that Kurosawa also edited most of his own films, or at least worked very, very closely with the editor. That helped him develop a definite style throughout his career. And there were a couple of things that he was particularly known for that we could see in The Hidden Fortress as well. One of them was he almost never cut back to the same camera setup. So like if you were filming a conversation, in most movies, you'd record one actor talking through the whole scene and then record the other actor talking through the whole scene and then cut between the two.
Right.
Whereas Kurosawa would plan in advance much more so that every part of the conversation was a new camera angle in order to highlight some important thing or action. And he also tended to ignore the 180 rule. Is there a better name for that, where you're not supposed to move the camera to the other side of the actors?
Yeah, the 180 rule is, I think, generally the term that we use. Is you shoot a scene from within the same 180 degrees, and if you cross that line, then your eye lines will look strange. I think that works actually since he wasn't shooting that kind of traditional back and forth coverage, then he kind of was able to break that rule because he was kind of pre-building those scenes in a way that flowed very naturally. And, you know, so it's one of those things I wouldn't have really noted it on my own upon first viewing. But yeah, now thinking about it now, it's like, yeah, they really didn't like cut back to the same setup a lot. Scenes just kind of flowed kind of one from one end to the other without a lot of back and forth. Sometimes it worked. There's a couple times where I kind of, it's like, well, it would have been nice if there had just been like a close up or like a two shot kind of back and forth here to kind of accentuate some of the performances or, you know, maybe some of the jokes.
I felt that way in the scene where the princess is singing the fire song as they're all tied up. Mm-hmm. And it was unusual to me that they decided to stay wide for that entire song.
Sat in that wide. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see, the second thing that he was known for was, I'm not going to be able to think of the word, but basically the type of editing where you, rather than doing a zoom on your camera, they would do three separate shots where each shot was a little closer into the subject.
Mm-hmm.
That apparently became one of his like noted techniques that he almost never used. Zooms or pans or things like that, he would figure out where to cut either on the action or subject or whatever, and just chop it all up into shorter shots.
Interesting.
Yeah. Lastly would be his use of the screen wipe as an editing transition. I'm sure you noticed that.
That was going to be my question, was how prevalent that is in his other films versus this one, because it's all over the place here. And so that's, again, an obvious thing that Lucas took for Star Wars, which has also appeared in a lot of those other influences that he had as well.
Like Flash Gordon and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly. I think that the screen wipe technique was very popular among all of those things. So it's interesting that it was here as well.
Mm-hmm. And apparently he helped popularize the technique as well. Like it wasn't used terribly often before he started using them.
It works great, especially because it's always horizontal wipes in this.
That's true.
And when it's traveling across that wide frame, it looks great, you know, because you really feel like an entire scene coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I imagine, you know, in a full screen frame, it wouldn't be quite as have as much of an impact to do that. But you watch it, you know, really that wipe, you know, kind of crawl across, especially with all these, you know, these vistas and these wide shots that he's doing and cutting between. I thought it was very effective.
It was interesting that it didn't. Well, no, I think I'm wrong now that I was about to say it, that the wipes weren't always to show the passage of time. Like in Star Wars, when they do a wipe, it's like in a completely different location afterwards or a different hours later or whatever.
Right.
I remember one sequence where I think the general was walking through the woods and they just used the wipe two or three times in a sequence of him just walking through the woods.
Yeah. Sometimes it would be big time jumps, but yeah, you'd have sequences like that where it's literally just like a slightly different part of the set and you just, you know.
Let's throw a wipe in there just to make it interesting.
Why not? It looks good.
Oh, I did remember the thing I was going to say about Laserdiscs earlier when we were talking about the transfer was that you mentioned that it looked pretty good and not noticeably horrible compared to the Blu-ray release. And that is something that I've done a lot of digging into with Laserdisc, because to me, it's a really interesting format in that it's actually entirely analog.
Right.
Rather than any digital process in there. So theoretically, the resolution is actually quite high because it's analog. In the same sense that like film being an analog format, you can zoom in quite a lot and still have detail before it starts washing away with the grain or whatever.
Right.
And with Laserdisc, at the time that they were popular, it was a big jump in technology, but we were still using old like CRT TVs and rear projection and stuff like that. So it didn't necessarily take advantage of what was possible with the format.
Mm-hmm.
But more recently, I'm part of a group on Facebook called Laserdisc Forever. That has over 10,000 people in there posting constantly. And there's a few people in there who have done a lot of really cool research into working a Laserdisc player into a modern setup with either like a 4K projector or a big LED TV or stuff like that. And have found that like with the right technology, you can actually get it looking as good as most DVDs.
Cool.
But with a nice, there's almost like a sort of a nice softness or a grain to it that is reminiscent of film itself versus like the super harsh digital look that you sometimes get when everything is like too sharp.
Yeah, well, especially with DVDs, because DVDs were digital and were like sharp, but were actually a very low digital resolution compared to especially what we're used to today.
Right.
And if you really look a lot of, you know, unless it was a really high quality later in life DVD, DVDs don't look very good.
Yeah. Not some of those early ones, especially.
Yeah. But again, at the time it was mostly analog TVs. So the your display itself was kind of softening that digital look a little bit. So it looked pretty good, you know. So like you compare an early DVD to a later DVD where they knew that it was more, they were going to digital TVs. There was a big difference in quality in terms of that digital compression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they still won't die. I'm shocked that Blu-ray is only like 10% of sales of movies and DVD is, I don't know, 70 or 80 or something.
I guess probably just because Blu-rays were here so briefly before everything switched to streaming that enough people were like, well, DVD's good enough, or I can watch it on Netflix. So I'm just going to not buy a Blu-ray player and I'll just keep getting DVDs.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is interesting that they're still so prevalent.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's see. I should turn it over to you. Are there any of the technical elements that caught your eye or anything you wanted to bring up?
I don't think there's any like big wow that I had of like, oh, like this one thing is so interesting and you know, new or anything like that. I did find it, I liked the sequence where they're running when all the soldiers are shooting at them and they would obviously have a shot with like a log or a hill being shot by like squibs or actual guns, and then they would very abruptly cut to the same shot at a very different time and the actors would pop up and then run away and like all the smoke would disappear because they weren't shooting at the same time, which is just, you know, one of those like, yeah, it works, it's fine, and then it's fun. It just kind of, you know, it showed, you know, where today they would either be compositing something like that in or they would just have squibs next to the actors going off.
Right.
And instead they're just like, yeah, we'll just do it later. It'll be fine. I thought that was pretty fun. I just like the general look of things because it was so much of it shot outside. So there's actually very few interiors.
True.
And so you either had, you know, like your kind of nighttime external lighting, or a lot of it was just very naturally lit. But just the locations were so rich in like texturally, like the mountains that they were shooting in. Mm-hmm. You know, and it went in the black and white. It had a very like Ansel Adams feel, you know, with just like these rough rocks, you know, with the natural kind of hard lighting of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that just, you know, just, I liked the visuals of that, which isn't any one particular technical thing of just, but just the way that they used the shape of the environment. And it was very, I thought that was very evocative, that a lot of that stood out to me. And again, kind of going back to the Western feel and the Treasure of the Sierra Madre, it was kind of the same thing. You know, these very rough, rocky terrain that just adds so much natural feel to it, you know, and texture to the world.
Right. Yeah. Which is, if I remember right, part of the reason that George Lucas went to Tunisia to film was just like that effect of being on location was was
and
so
the very rocky desert
so much.
Those cliffs and crags and stuff that they had, it makes a lot of sense. And I mentioned this while we were watching the movie, and I'm actually very surprised that we don't see more American films using like the Japanese mountains as locations, especially like for sci-fi locations, because I thought they have a very distinct look that I haven't really seen in many other places.
Right. Yeah, I've seen movies use like Ireland and Scotland and Norway for a lot of like alien rocky locations out on the fjords. But I agree. I've seen very little Western productions using Asia as a backdrop.
Yeah, it reminded me that there's a sequence in Lord of the Rings where they're in these kind of rocky mountains, you know, and obviously that's New Zealand. But I imagine it's very similar. Terrain just being kind of, you know, around that Pacific Rim area that they would have, you know, you'd end up with a similar geological area. But that was like the one big like Western release that I can think of that has terrain like that, and even that's a very short sequence, you know, of obviously a very big film. So yeah, like I'm actually surprised, like especially like the newer Star Wars films, which are like, you know, we're getting off the green screen, we're going to these back to locations, that they didn't use a place like Japan in those mountains, which are very, very distinct and could be made very alien looking very quickly.
I wonder if it's just impossible to get permits or something, some silly reason like that.
Maybe, or they watch this movie and they're like, everybody's falling down these rocky mountains a lot. We don't want to do that. That looked hard.
Like they did 18 times in The Hidden Fortress.
Yeah. Climbing up and falling down mountains, the Hidden Fortress story.
Um,
I did love that gag. That was like when they're climbing the mountain that first time. And I'm like, oh, the pacing on this is so strange. They're climbing for so long. Like, what an odd thing. And then the reveal that he's down there and there's obviously something going on. It's like, okay, that paid off pretty well. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Why didn't they just take the shortcut? All right. With that out of the way, Nick, let's talk Star Wars.
Okay.
I brought you on as an expert witness in all things Star Wars. How do you think this movie compared?
Well, you definitely see the bones of it, and it's very well recorded that this was a huge influence on George Lucas when he was conceiving Star Wars. And it's obvious because you have the droid characters, you know, wandering through the desert at the beginning of the film, and the concept of like these characters, like the window characters of the peasants, are not the main protagonists of the film. They're the main characters of the film, but like the real important, quote unquote, important action is happening to the other characters.
Right.
And I thought that was very interesting. I think that's kind of why Star Wars works, is you have those characters looking and commenting on things. So yeah, I think, you know, it just kind of, you know, taking those, all of those elements, you know, with like this, with the sprawling adventure and the kind of larger than life characters and, you know, the general and the princess and they're getting from A to B, you know, kind of, your MacGuffin plot, you know, you have this gold and they're always so concerned about this gold. You know, I think it's such a, like a beautiful, very simple, straightforward story. And that's where the success of Star Wars is too, is it's big, large archetypal characters, you know, fighting against good and evil. And I think it works very well compared to that.
Mm-hmm. Which characters do you think match up between Hidden Fortress and Star Wars? Obviously we have the two peasants being C-3PO and RGD2.
Right. Even down to like the antagonistic dialogue, which I love.
And right.
I really hope somebody has taken the dialogue from Hidden Fortress, or at least the subtitles, and put them under those scenes from New Hope, because I think that'd be very funny.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully someone listening to this years from now will do it.
Hopefully. Then again, I don't know. It's the internet. I'm sure it's been done.
Yeah. Well, if I find it, I'll put it in the post when I upload this.
Right. You know, and I think.
All right. How about the general?
The general princess. I'd like to say the princess, because you have, you know, obviously being a princess, you know, the kind of the straight one-to-one, and really just her character too. Like, again, she's never a damsel in distress. And even though she's being rescued, and even in Star Wars, Princess Leia is being rescued, but not, she doesn't need to be rescued. She would have figured it out on her own, and kind of does. Mm-hmm. And this princess is the same way. She's kind of like, well, I'll be rescued. I'll go. This is fine, but she's a very active part of it. And like when the bandits or the peasants leave, they try to steal the gold at one point. And they're like, oh no, we can't cross the river here. And they go back, oh, the horses are gone. And she just stole them back. She just kind of followed them and took them back. And was like, I hate these guys. This sucks. Here, by the way, here's all the horses, you know, like she actually is quite capable on her own as a character. And I think that had to have been a big influence on Princess Leia, because she is, you know, and the same thing too, like she's very young. She's kind of thrust into this leadership role, you know, with like the tragedy of losing her people kind of a thing. But takes it very, very much in stride, you know, like Leia is, I think a lot of people agree, like the strongest character, like just in terms of like raw gumption in Star Wars. And a lot of the people around her are weaker and kind of give into their foibles, but she never does, even throughout all of them and through the new ones even too. That's one of the strengths, I think, of the newer films, is that Leia is kind of the bedrock of the entire freedom movement. Mm-hmm. And I think this princess very much kind of embodies that. She, you know, and they talk about how, well, no, she doesn't show her emotion. She doesn't, you know, she takes all of this in stride and she's doing so well. And you do get the scene of catharsis from her of like, well, she doesn't show her tears to anyone. It doesn't mean she doesn't have them, but when push comes to shove, you know, she definitely is in charge of the situation that she's in. And I really, really liked that as a character. And then especially compared to Princess Leia, very, very, very similar in that manner.
Hmm. I didn't realize until, you mentioned her being thrust into a leadership role, that there is a parallel between the destruction of Alderaan and the beginning of the Hidden Fortress, which is that the clan, the Akazuki clan, has been just decimated in their homeland, including the leader, the princess's father, which is what is forcing them to go seek safe haven in this other landscape. All right, so then we have the general.
Yes.
Where do you see him falling in?
Well, it's so interesting because that's where you kind of start losing your comparisons, because he's kind of the like Obi-Wan character they discover in the desert, but then he's also the like brash hero. There's not a lot of like the Luke Skywalker character. You get some like Han Solo, you know, because he's kind of smirky and he kind of has the easygoing nature, you know. But I also got a lot of, especially initially when he's interacting with the peasants, like a lot of vibes from Yoda when they introduce Yoda in Empire Strikes Back, where he's kind of messing with them a little bit.
Right.
You know, and he's not revealing really who he is, because Obi-Wan pretty much just like pops up and he's like, what's up? I'm Obi-Wan Kenobi. Whereas Yoda's a lot more cagey about like who he is and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. You are the great warrior general. And that reveal, I think, is kind of where that comes from. So they definitely split the general character into and gave aspects of him to a lot of other characters in Star Wars, which is so interesting when you think of like the direct one-to-one comparison of like the peasants to the droids and the princess to the princess. And then, but then it's like the general to six other characters.
Do you think that the I don't know what to call him, the warlord that has the scar across his face, do you think he became Darth Vader or something else?
I don't know. I found that interesting, and I thought about this throughout the viewing of the film, and especially compared to Star Wars. One of the strengths I think of Star Wars is it characterizes the villains. Mm-hmm. And you see scenes of the villains, and they have motivations and characterizations, and like they talk to each other, and you know, and you might not agree with their motivations or understand them, but it, by having that window into them and like watching them blow up Alderaan, and like Tarkin is happy that Alderaan was destroyed and Vader is mad that Obi-Wan is back, you get them, and so you as an audience member are then like want to see what happens and want to see their demise, like, you know, Grand Moff Tarkin, you want to watch him get blown up and at the end because you hate him for what he did. But with Hidden Fortress, you don't really have any characterization of the villains. It's just, oh, right, this clan wiped out this clan. We don't want to be found by them. And until very, very late in the movie, there's suddenly this like warlord character and they're like, oh, I really wish I had fought you at one point. Yeah, me too. Let's fight. And then he shows back up at the end with this, you know, kind of fun, like, you know, he does the releasing them from prison. And my favorite line of the movie, which is just, forgive me for defecting, you know, an interesting thing, but that character the character's only in like three scenes of the whole movie. So it doesn't, there's not a lot of payoff there. And I think, you know, that's one of the strengths of Star Wars, which, you know, some movies do, and but a lot of them don't, of you, by giving the villains scenes to themselves and giving them plots and their own, you know, room to breathe as characters. That's a big strength. And I think that's one of the weakest parts of the film, is you don't, you know, the villains are just kind of this nebulous, well, this clan is bad and is hunting us.
Right.
You know, and other than a couple scenes where they're interacting, there's really no characterization of that. So you don't kind of, you don't care as much why. Yeah, so there's really no direct, I think, in this case. Obviously, you know, Darth Vader has the very samurai influenced look about him, and they did a lot of his design comes from that, and with the armor and everything. But I think maybe this particular movie is not a direct influence on the character, I wouldn't think.
Sure. So I've got some background notes on the creation of Star Wars that I thought were pretty interesting. So George Lucas, he saw the movie Seven Samurai when he was in film school. And that was what introduced him to the world of Japanese cinema, and Kurosawa in particular. So he went on to see a lot of Kurosawa's work and be very heavily inspired by it. He said in multiple interviews that that he was influenced by Hidden Fortress. Like, he admitted that.
Yeah.
And said that it was almost entirely the window characters, like you said, of the peasants becoming the two robots. But it turns out that the first synopsis that George Lucas wrote of Star Wars in 1973, he borrowed, like, almost word for word, the plot summary of The Hidden Fortress from a book on Akira Kurosawa. And I was going to read them here just because I thought it was funny. So in the Star Wars synopsis, it begins, "It is the 33rd century, a period of civil wars in the galaxy. A rebel princess with her family, her retainers, and the clan treasure is being pursued. If they can cross territory controlled by the Empire and reach a friendly planet, they will be saved. The Sovereign knows this and posts a reward for the capture of the princess." Now here is The Hidden Fortress from the 1965 book, The Films of Akira Kurosawa. "It is the 16th century, a period of civil wars. A princess with her family, her retainers, and the clan treasure is being pursued. If they can cross enemy territory and reach a friendly province, they will be saved. The enemy knows this and posts a reward for the capture of the princess." He went on to loosely adapt multiple other sections into his original synopsis. To his credit, he did expand on and change quite a lot by the time that Star Wars became what we know of today.
Yes. And some of those original treatments and, like, that kind of super, super early script have more of this, of just the kind of getting the princess from A to B plot versus, you know, the rescue and then fight kind of plot that Star Wars became. And I kind of want to go back, because they did at one point adapt one of the early screenplays into a comic series called The Star Wars, which is what it was originally called. Yeah. And they used a lot of the very early Ralph McQuarrie designs for the characters and stuff like that, you know, which obviously have then very much evolved into what we see today. And so I kind of want to go back and read that again and see if that, because I believe that's much closer to this Hidden Fortress type plot than Star Wars itself ended up being.
I love those concept drawings. I remember the Luke having that weird, like, breathing apparatus on his face was a big one I remember. Well, Lucas, he originally considered buying the rights to The Hidden Fortress when he was making Star Wars, because he knew it was is as close as that. But that ended up not happening. Then later, he actually approached Toshiro Mifune to star in Star Wars as either Obi-Wan or Darth Vader.
I did recall hearing that he offered him the Obi-Wan Kenobi role, which would have been kind of fascinating, actually.
Yeah.
I think it would have given a very different tone to the movie.
it'd be fun to see a deep fake video of him put on top of Alec Guinness's character.
Oh, yeah, that'd be odd. The voice wouldn't work.
no, not at all. Eventually, we'll have deepfake voices too, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. So Mifune, this is according to his daughter in a more recent interview. He turned the job down because he was really proud of Samurai films and all of the work that he'd done on them, and he thought that Star Wars was just going to be another cheap sci-fi knockoff that would lessen somewhat the noble history of samurai films.
I can see that, because they borrowed so much of that samurai iconography, you know, so I can see his logic of, like, well, no, this isn't, like, you know, It's a little appropriative, and it does it, I think, well enough that it's not too bad. But I can see how someone known for the samurai films and proud of the samurai films would be like, well, no, I'm not going to be part of this thing that is, you know, almost making fun of them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. the story afterwards that I have is that after, or I should say, by the time that George Lucas was introduced to Kurosawa's movies and started falling in love with them, Kurosawa actually couldn't get any work in the film industry in the 70s, because he had had, I think, a big flop with one of his movies, and suddenly he couldn't get a budget for anything. And it got so bad that he actually attempted suicide in 1971.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And thankfully he survived and went on to make several more movies. But this was a really dark period for him. And after Star Wars came out, George Lucas actually had a meeting with Akira Kurosawa. And Lucas wanted to find out if there was anything that Kurosawa wanted to work on. Because Lucas now had all of this cachet in the industry. And so Kurosawa proposed a movie called Kagemusha. And Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola ended up producing that movie. And it came out at the 1980 Cannes Film Festival and won the Palme d'Or.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh. I'd never heard of that. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hadn't either.
It is so strange because they feel so separate. Like Akira Kurosawa and George Lucas feel like they're of like so completely different eras that it's like, it's weird mm-hmm. that they're like, oh yeah, they hung out and were friends and made movies together later on. Like it's so odd like to think, because actually, and this is like kind of one of those weird, like, you know, time has no meaning kind of things I realized is that like the time from when Hidden Fortress was released to when the original Star Wars was released is a shorter amount of time from when The Phantom Menace was released to now.
Ah, yes.
Which is like, oh, that's so weird.
I agree. I really like about that story that people have fun ragging on George Lucas for creatively stealing a lot of work, including Kurosawa's. But the fact that he really did recognize who his influences were and admired them to the point that he was able to do that for one of his cinema heroes later on, I thought was very cool. A nice bit of character.
Yeah, I think that is great.
Mm-hmm. Then that brings me to the final question, which I pose to all of our guests, is now that you know all of this background and you've seen the movie, the Criterion Collection has a very simple mission statement, which is they want to preserve important contemporary and historical works of cinema. And that's the only word they use is important. But with that, do you think that this movie belongs in the Criterion Collection?
I don't know. It's an interesting question because it's so different from like, does it belong on like a top movies of all time list?
Right.
Because that's such a different metric. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think in terms of preservation, yeah, I think so. It's kind of one of those like, well, if not the Criterion Collection, then who? Like who would be doing sure. it? Who, and like even like when I was watching it on HBO, well, that it has the Criterion logo. Like the only reason we have a high quality version and restoration of the film is the Criterion Collection. Mm-hmm. So had they not done it, would we even have ready access to this film at all and be able to have this discussion and comparison? You know, because it is so important to the birth of Star Wars, which has become such a massive cultural touchstone, mm-hmm. you know, it is important in that way. And there's obviously a very different argument is, you know, like is Star Wars that important, you know, quote unquote important,
sure.
but you can't deny that it is definitely, you know, a big part of kind of our cultural zeitgeist.
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So in that way, yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of films deserve to be preserved like that and be seen and available. And if the Criterion Collection wasn't out there doing it, you know, how many more of these would we have maybe not lost outright, but would at least not have these high quality versions and be able to go back and watch it so readily and so easily. And I think that's great. Is it like one of my favorite films of all time? Maybe not. It's fun. It's cool. And it's such a neat historical thing. It makes me really want to watch other Akira Kurosawa movies now that I finally dipped my toe into that water. And I want, you know, and knowing this is kind of one of his lighter, you know, more popcorn fare, I really want to dive in and try some of his other work, which I imagine will have a bit more of an impact just kind of artistically and personally, you know. But I think in general, I mean, there's very few movies that aren't deserving of some level of preservation. So yes, I think absolutely. I think it's wonderful that they did it and we're able to have these movies and these discussions.
Well put. Thank you. So on that note, I think I will conclude this episode. I want to thank you very much for being here with me today and watching it.
Thank you for having me on. This was wonderful. It was a absolutely fantastic experience.
You got it. And just so everybody knows, the next episode is going to be Spine number 11 and a half. It doesn't technically have its own number, but it is The Red Balloon. And we will see you then.